Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Aiding and Abetting, U.S. Foreign Assistance and State Violence by Jessica Trisco Darden. Narrated by Rebecca Gibble. Publisher's note: this audiobook refers to figures and tables included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Preface. On October 26, 1973, a family huddled on the tarmac of Manila International Airport, waiting to board a plane that would take them to an unknown future. My mother, her five siblings, and her parents were leaving for San Francisco. The eight tickets cost the equivalent of about $14,000 today. They sold everything they had, car, house, furniture, to buy them. In order to leave the country, each family member had to get clearance from the National Bureau of Investigation, the police, and the tax authorities. They had to endure interrogations and medical screenings. They left behind family, friends, and in my mother's case, a sweetheart. When the plane took off, the family said goodbye to the only country they had ever known, a place where my grandparents had survived a brutal Japanese occupation and tasted the beginnings of a country at peace, and eventually enjoyed a happy and comfortable life. They would never again call the Philippines home. After a brief stop in San Francisco, my family arrived on October 30, 1973, in Vancouver, Canada, where I was later born and grew up. Like many immigrants, the eight of them lived together in a family member's basement until they could afford a home of their own. My grandmother, 44 at the time, tried her hand at a number of jobs, as a cashier, as a mail clerk at the post office, and was eventually able to get a data entry position at a state-run insurance company. In the Philippines, she had been a college graduate with a well-paying job. But both of my grandparents settled for jobs far less prestigious than the ones they once had. That's the typical immigration story. The older generation makes sacrifices for the opportunities of the next generation. But my family had not longed to immigrate to a new land. They had a comfortable and even privileged life in the Philippines. They were forced to leave, largely because of the influence of Western powers on their country and the fate of President Ferdinand Marcos. A lawyer and career politician, Marcos was democratically elected as president of the Philippine Republic in 1965, and in 1969, he was the first leader ever to be elected to a second term. But on September 21, 1972, as leftist demonstrations and a communist insurgency roiled the country, Marcos declared martial law. A nationwide curfew was immediately imposed. Press freedoms declined overnight. A total of 292 radio stations were closed throughout the country. Seven television stations were shut down, as were 16 dailies published in Filipino, Chinese, English, and Spanish. Key opposition figures, including the former governor and Senator Benigno Ninoy Aquino Jr., were accused of murder, illegal possession of firearms, and subversion, and placed under military arrest. After Ninoy had endured a hunger strike and 2 years of detention, a military tribunal sentenced him to death, although the execution was never carried out. Student activists and media personalities critical of Marcos were also detained. Congress was shut down, and the following year, a new constitution was declared that extended Marcos's rule. My mother, herself a student activist, and her family were among a fortunate few who sold what they could and fled to Australia, Canada, or the United States. Amnesty International claims that 70,000 Filipinos were imprisoned and 34,000 tortured during the almost 10-year period of martial law, September 1971 to January 1981. A total of 3,257 people are thought to have been killed by the military under the Marcos dictatorship, though many families will never know what happened to loved ones who simply disappeared. Lurid stories drifted out of the Philippines. Imprisonments and repeated rapes. American priests arrested and deported. When finally given the opportunity to air their grievances in 2013, Filipinos alleged 75,730 claims of human rights violations against the Marcos regime. Yet, despite all of this, Marcos was considered a friend of the United States. A History of American Imperialism, Liberation from Japanese Occupation, and the 1951 Mutual Defense Treaty bound together the security of the Philippines and the United States, committing them to mutual aid in the face of an aggressor in the Pacific. The long-standing presence of U.S. military bases throughout the country gave the United States access to the region, but also meant that it had to maintain amicable relations with the Philippines. That was relatively easy, because Marcos's struggle against an insurgency led by the Chinese communist-leaning New People's Army made him, like General Suharto in Indonesia, a key figure in the fight against communism in Asia. The United States did not want to see the Philippines fall to communism, and in that sense, America's Cold War policy clearly succeeded there. But by assuming responsibility for the Philippines' defense and training its military, the United States allowed the leaders of the Philippines to focus on internal threats to their power, to their wealth, and to their continued rule. The foreign assistance provided to the Philippines during the Marcos era also undermined the broader development goals that the United States had for the country. During the decade of martial law, U.S. military assistance to the Philippines totaled the equivalent of about $1.16 billion, while overall foreign aid from the United States exceeded $3.5 billion. No matter what Marcos did, American aid dollars flowed. But even as aid kept coming, the Philippines, which had been one of the most prosperous countries in Asia, became one of the poorest. A system of crony capitalism enriched Marcos's friends and allies. Corruption reached far into the judiciary and police forces. Shortly after the declaration of martial law, the state took ownership of Philippine Airlines and forced foreign companies to give up their stakes in the Philippines National Oil Company. The military bought private steel mills to form the National Steel Corporation. And while the elite pillaged the economy, the percentage of Filipinos living in poverty grew. But eventually, the Filipino people fought back. 20 years after the People Power Revolution toppled the Marcos regime and he fled with his family to Hawaii, my mother returned to the Philippines. I sat beside her as our plane landed at Manila Ninoy Aquino International Airport. In the years between my mother's departure and her return in 2005, Ninoy Aquino had become the face of Philippine democracy. He was released from a military prison and allowed to travel with his family to the United States for medical treatment. After a brief stint lecturing at Harvard and MIT, Ninoy left to return to the Philippines and lead the opposition to Marcos's rule. He was assassinated with a single gunshot wound to the head when he landed in Manila at that same airport in August 1983. Although 16 servicemen, including a general, were eventually convicted in 1990 for his murder, conspiracy theories and allegations of the Marcos family's direct involvement persist. Ninoy's death marked the beginning of the end of the Marcos regime. Millions of Filipinos took to the streets, and the United States finally began to press Marcos for meaningful political reform. Ninoy's wife, Corazon Aquino, would challenge Marcos in elections and ultimately become the first woman president of the Philippines, following Marcos's resignation. Their son, Benigno Aquino III, would become president in June 2010 and sign into law the Human Rights Victims Reparation and Recognition Act. The act acknowledged the victims of human rights violations during the Marcos regime and offered them financial compensation for their suffering. Yo soy Ninoy. I am Ninoy. Only 2 months after my mother's return to the Philippines, President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, herself the daughter of a former president, declared a national state of emergency after an attempted military coup against her, the second attempt in less than 3 years. In the months and years that followed, opposition journalists continued to be arrested and murdered. The Philippines was ranked alongside Russia in freedom of the press. Democracy is a fragile thing. Some members of Congress urged the United States to make military assistance to the Arroyo government dependent on the end of extrajudicial killings. Little came of their efforts. And although Arroyo and other former politicians have since done prison time for corruption, None have been held to account for the human rights abuses that occurred under their watch. What exactly, then, was the United States buying with decades of foreign aid to my mother's country, the Philippines? After the closure of American military bases in the country in 1992, U.S. military assistance dropped by 84%. Over the course of 4 years, military aid to the Philippines went from $316 million to $1.3 million. Clearly, the continuing threat of communism in the Philippines, seen in attacks by the New People's Army, wasn't enough to sustain America's attention once its military bases were gone. Nor was an Islamist insurgency in the country's south. Economic aid fell as well, while millions of Filipinos, roughly 20% of the population, were left to live in extreme poverty. Democracy held. But when looking at the Philippines now, the clearest outcomes of decades of U.S. support appear to be endemic corruption, a preference for justice outside of the courts, and a shocking naivete about the risks of authoritarian rule. Today, the Philippines is experiencing renewed violence and movement toward autocracy. Rodrigo Duterte's election as president in May 2016 in many ways demonstrates the long-term consequences of foreign intervention in the Philippines. Long associated with death squads in his home city of Davao, Duterte launched a national war on drugs that claimed over 7,000 lives in its first 9 months. President Donald J. Trump praised him for doing an unbelievable job on the drug problem. On May 23, 2017, Duterte declared martial law in the southern province of Mindanao and later threatened to expand it throughout the country. Unsurprisingly, he supported the reburial of Marcos in the country's Cemetery for Heroes, Libingan Nima Bayani, in honor reserved for former presidents and distinguished military officers, but formerly denied to the dictator. Duterte also supported Marcos's son in his quest for the independently elected role of vice president. Bongbong, as Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is known, came a close second. The possibility of a new era of human rights abuses in the Philippines feels more real than ever. This book examines how U.S. foreign assistance policy has shaped state violence throughout the developing world, from its inception in 1949 to the present day. America's ability to influence violence abroad is not simply some long-gone Cold War phenomenon. I illustrate how foreign assistance, even when given for benign or altruistic purposes, can be diverted by recipient governments to support their continued hold on power through violence. Simply put, foreign aid can do as much harm as it can good. I dedicate this book to those who lost their lives or left their homes because of violence and unrest that in a different sort of world might not have occurred. In his Message to the 21st Century, Isaiah Berlin said of the atrocities of the Russian Revolution, the Second World War, and the post-war revolutions that tore through the developing world, they were not natural disasters, but preventable human crimes. And whatever those who believe in historical determinism may think, they could have been averted. The story of the Philippines could have been different if the United States had used its foreign aid more judiciously. Policies, well-intentioned or not, well-devised or not, have very real consequences. Introduction. Aiding Freedom, Human Rights, and U.S. Foreign Assistance. Whether foreign intervention in the affairs of a sovereign state is justified is at once a practical and a moral question, a question which is often raised in regard to so-called humanitarian interventions, economic sanctions, and international financial institutions such as the World Bank. The study of foreign intervention has ranged from analyses of covert operations during the Cold War to investigations of American efforts to promote democracy abroad and U.S. support for state and non-state actors during civil wars. Although it is broadly accepted that such interventions are not neutral, it is less often acknowledged that they can both inadvertently and intentionally contribute to the very dynamics they seek to disrupt. In the study of foreign intervention, foreign assistance has rarely been a focus. This is surprising because since its inception in 1949, The United States Foreign Assistance Program has been seen by policymakers in Washington, D.C. as one of the country's primary means for influencing the political and economic orientations of other countries, and as a powerful tool for encouraging higher human rights standards. Many believe that it is possible for the international community and individual donor nations, such as the United States, to use foreign aid to buy better behavior from aid recipients, or at least to raise the costs of human rights violations. The rationale underlying such beliefs is that once countries have become dependent on foreign assistance, they won't risk upsetting the aid donor because that could lead to a reduction or curtailment of aid. In this view, aid recipients are treated much like a child given an iPad as a gift. It becomes something that concerned parents can threaten to take away whenever the child's behavior becomes unruly. But international politics is not that simple. Foreign donors, such as the United States, often face scenarios in which a government receiving aid violates the very rights they are tasked to protect. More important, foreign aid may be a contributing factor to human rights violations in the first place. In this book, I examine how U.S. foreign assistance policy contributes to state violence and government repression in countries receiving American aid. State violence, the use of force by state agents against civilians in ways that violate fundamental human rights, and government repression, the actual or threatened use of physical sanctions, including both violent and nonviolent means, against an individual or organization, are both ways in which state agents seek to control and constrain the behavior and beliefs of citizens in the interest of the state and its institutions. My focus is therefore on how foreign aid can undermine individual freedoms and embolden repressive rulers. Sometimes this is an unintended or secondary effect of U.S. foreign assistance. Other times it is an explicit goal. While foreign assistance has undoubtedly had positive effects globally, ranging from improved infant mortality rates and control of infectious diseases to increased literacy, it is crucial to know when, where, and how aid harms more than it helps. Foreign aid, the American way. On January 20, 1949, President Harry S. Truman stood in front of the Capitol and declared, "It may be our lot to experience, and in a large measure bring about, a major turning point in the long history of the human race." His second inaugural address laid out four courses of action for the pursuit of peace and freedom. The first was unfaltering support for the United Nations, UN. The second promised what would become the Marshall Plan, a massive aid program to bring about economic recovery and stave off the advance of communism, named after Secretary of State George Marshall. The third course of action would lead to the establishment of NATO, arguably the world's most important military alliance. The fourth course of action, what came to be known as Truman's fourth point, or point four, aimed to reshape the developing world. More than half the people of the world are living in conditions approaching misery. Their food is inadequate. They are victims of disease. Their economic life is primitive and stagnant. Their poverty is a handicap and a threat, both to them and to more prosperous areas. For the first time in history, humanity possesses the knowledge and skill to relieve the suffering of these people. As historian Amanda K. McVetty notes, "It was the perfect foreign policy program, morally good, economically feasible, and most importantly, diplomatically strategic, all of which made it palatable to the American public." Under Truman, the U.S. foreign assistance program would not be simply a handout, but neither would it be the predatory system established by imperial powers. Its aim would be to help the free peoples of the world, through their own efforts, to grow more, to produce more, to build more, and ultimately to lighten their burdens. Unlike the Marshall Plan, the Point 4 program was based on the concept of long-term aid to nations that had never industrialized or been connected to the global economy. The Point 4 program would help the United States achieve existing policy objectives, including increased national economic productivity, a more balanced world economic structure, peace, and the wider spread of democracy abroad. Its ability to do good seemed boundless. It took time to translate Truman's vision into practice. The Act for International Development was signed into law on June 5, 1950. Later that year, the Technical Cooperation Administration was established within the State Department to administer the Point 4 program. David Ekblad writes that while various bodies had been responsible for uplift or civilizing efforts that were developmental programs in all but name in the Philippines or during the extended U.S. military occupation of Haiti, these had never been given a perennial global mission. The Point 4 program was fundamentally different. The global scope of Truman's vision was reflected in the initial agreements signed, first with Iran on October 19, 1950, followed by Liberia, Brazil, Chile, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Indonesia, and Pakistan. The United States' vision of foreign aid shifted somewhat toward greater security concerns in October 1951, with the passage of the Mutual Security Act. The Mutual Security Act was a response to communist gains following the 1949 revolution in China and the invasion of South Korea by North Korea in June 1950. It explicitly harnessed U.S. foreign aid in service of the Cold War, a policy that continued as Soviet aid to the Third World also expanded throughout the 1950s and 1960s. During this period, the United States developed new instruments for providing military assistance, including Military Assistance Program, MAP, Grants and Foreign Military Financing, FMF, that enabled partner governments to receive equipment and training from the United States or access equipment through American commercial channels by funding military spending and subsidizing military equipment purchases. International Military Education and Training, IMET, funds permitted foreign military officer and personnel training to take place abroad, as well as at U.S. staff colleges on a grant basis. Over the past 50 years, roughly 500,000 foreigners have been trained in U.S. military institutions thanks to American taxpayers. Other foreign aid tools were soon developed. Under President Dwight Eisenhower, the Food for Peace Program, Public Law or PL 480, was established. This marked the beginning of America's food aid program, which continues today. Through subsidized sales of grain, cotton, and other agricultural products, PL 480 helps transfer excess American farm production to the developing world. The Food for Peace program established by Eisenhower was and still is strongly backed by a domestic constituency, American farm organizations, who directly benefit from the government purchases that make food aid possible. The American shipping industry benefits as well. Less than 2 months after PL 480 was signed, a requirement was added that at least 50% of all U.S. government food aid shipments must be carried overseas by U.S.-flagged vessels. This requirement has made its way into newer American food aid programs as well, including the Food for Progress program and the McGovern-Dole International Food for Education and Child Nutrition program. As early as the 1950s, the tensions in U.S. foreign aid policy were apparent. Humanitarian, national security, and commercial interests all shaped how American aid was distributed. Then, as now, U.S. foreign assistance was not driven by a single consistent vision of what it could or should achieve. Yet, few politicians openly acknowledged these tensions. Instead, moral imperatives were often evoked as a justification for continued aid. In his inaugural address, President John F. Kennedy promised to those people in the huts and villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, "We pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves for whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right." Only a decade after formal foreign aid institutions were created, providing foreign assistance had become simply what America did. The passage of the Foreign Assistance Act in 1961, arguably the definitive innovation in U.S. foreign aid policy, did little to resolve the tensions. The Foreign Assistance Act defines U.S. foreign assistance as any tangible or intangible item provided by the United States government, including by means of gift, loan, sale, credit, or guarantee, to a foreign country or international organization under this or any other act, including but not limited to any training, service, or technical advice, any item of real, personal, or mixed property, any agricultural commodity, United States dollars, and any currencies of any foreign country government which are owned by the United States government. As a result, the United States has a much more expansive understanding of what constitutes foreign assistance than most other countries. Indeed, what many countries count as their foreign aid, official development assistance as defined by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, covers a relatively narrow slice of America's foreign assistance efforts. Given the scope of America's foreign assistance, Kennedy created the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, as the main administrative body. USAID administers bilateral, country-to-country development assistance, for example, funds for building schools in rural areas or new farming initiatives in individual countries. With a staff of more than 9,500, the agency is responsible for overseeing the implementation of projects by thousands of contractors, consultants, and non-governmental organizations, NGOs, and tracking and administering aid from a variety of U.S. government agencies. For example, the State Department provides economic aid to support initiatives in areas including global health and child survival, narcotics control, migration and refugee assistance, and non-proliferation and terrorism-related programs, among others. The Department of Agriculture largely funds PL-480 food aid programs, in addition to other health and agricultural services, whereas the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention provide assistance for global health programs, including malaria and pandemics prevention. USAID's original emphasis was on solving long-term development problems, but as soon as a year after its creation, critics complained that USAID was too slow and showed too few results. Such criticism persists. U.S. foreign aid policy has consistently been torn between supporting the common good, realized through economic development, and furthering America's own security and diplomatic interests. These conflicting priorities and policies have produced what is at once the world's largest foreign aid program and also one of the most incoherent. As political theorist Hans Morgenthau noted more than 50 years ago, the provision of resources to other states has historically been used by dominant powers to create and maintain ties with countries in order to shape their political and economic orientations. During the Cold War, the United States consistently increased the level of aid it provided to states under the threat of Soviet subversion or the actions of Soviet client states. In signing the Foreign Assistance Act, Kennedy noted that the bill provides military assistance to countries which are on the rim of the communist world and under direct attack. It provides economic assistance to those governments which are under attack from widespread misery and social discontent, which are exploited by our adversaries. But under President Lyndon Baines Johnson, aid became explicitly strategic. Foreign aid was used as a carrot to entice recipients to support U.S. policy objectives, while the possibility of withholding aid could be used as a stick to punish movement away from those same objectives. Secretary of State Dean Rusk argued, "A properly directed foreign assistance program is a vital instrument of United States foreign policy. Economic and military assistance remain far and away the most powerful means at our command to influence the massive forces at work in the less developed nations. They are our primary source of influence on the economic and military evolution of most of the countries of the non-communist world." Diplomatically or strategically important countries received high levels of U.S. aid, often with little consideration of whether the aid would have any effect on their economic development. Rather, foreign aid helped strengthen regimes such as that of Zaire's Mobutu Sese Seko, which received American aid from 1960 to 1990, in order to prevent a communist-leaning ruler from coming to power. The strategic use of foreign aid became so integral to U.S. foreign policy that Carol Lancaster, a former deputy director of USAID, argued that foreign aid as we know it began as an instrument of Cold War diplomacy. In the mid-1970s, U.S. foreign aid policy shifted as Congress passed a series of amendments introducing human rights conditionality. The Harkin Amendment, named after Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa, to the International Development and Food Assistance Act of 1975.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?